Welcome to the show.
I'm Andrew Quinn, a senior principal at Slalom Consulting. It's a modern consulting firm focused on strategy, technology, and business transformation. I'm part of our strategy and operations group in New York City, and I'm heavily focused on helping businesses enter into Web3. In the past 6 months to a year especially, we've had more and more clients coming to us and talking about we need to understand Web3 better. Our boards are interested in us starting to make a move to get into this space. Help us out. Tell us how to get there. And practically, that means we spend a lot of our time on education and advisory, as Web3 is still in its early phases from a business adoption standpoint. And that means lots of exciting things are happening. So I'm glad to be here to talk to you about it today.
So tell me about, take me back 5-6 years. Where were you? What were you doing? And then what was your first introduction to blockchain? I think a lot of people, me included, I think we first heard about it, and then at a later point, we found that there was application to your business life or your personal life. So when did that moment click for you?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think everybody has a little sense of the journey from it being something like a passing interest or a hobby to seeing that now this is becoming more of a business focus and something that's starting to shape the economy around us. So 5-6 years ago, I was doing still technology-related consulting. I worked with Accenture at the time, a lot of data and analytics teams. At that point in time, businesses were focused on how do they stand up proper analytics capabilities. A lot has happened since then. We now have ChatGPT, which you can log into, and it'll have a conversation with you almost as well as a human will. But at that point, companies were still building the building blocks of developing proper AI, and that's where a lot of the business world was focused. So for me, at that point in time, I kept an eye on what was happening with blockchain. I read about it a little bit. I said, oh, cool, there's this digital currency out there called Bitcoin now, and isn't this a nice little novelty that is cool to dabble in and maybe get your hands a little bit dirty and just seeing how it works? But it was always something I considered on the side, not a core focus of my professional life, because there weren't a ton of professional opportunities at that point in time, unless you were a hardcore developer who was contributing to the core Bitcoin code or something along those lines. A lot happened with me since then. So I went to Europe and got an MBA, dabbled in the startup life over there. All throughout that, I've always had a little bit of an interest and a hand in technology. I like to do a little coding just to stay fresh and stay engaged in a social media that's focused on a lot of Web3 or technology topics. And then it really started coming to a head, I would say, about a year ago, when I felt this intersection of the technology world that's been on the side, a little bit on the fringe, with blockchain and the Web3 ecosystem that's built on top of it, that started merging with professional life. When clients started talking about it, when we started seeing projects pop up, and when we started seeing a need to get engaged and teach and coach people about how this is working, that all started coming together. And now what was a bit of a hobby before is now a focus of my career.
Did you go to London School of Economics, or where did you go?
Not LSE. We played LSE in volleyball during our NBA tournament, and those guys, man, they recruit athletes to that school, so you got to be prepped. I went to HEC Paris. You could say a little bit of a rivalry between LSE and HEC Paris. So we met a bunch of those guys, and they were fun to get to know, but they got us in the volleyball tournament, so I got a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, I think.
One of my best friends from growing up went to London School of Economics, and he talks great about it.
Yeah, it's a cool, good school for sure.
Yep. So the first time I heard about blockchain or Bitcoin or Web3 was watching the movie Social Network with the Winklevoss twins, and I was Googling something and Bitcoin came up. When was the first time that you, can you remember the first time that you heard about blockchain?
I think, yeah, I do remember. I was teaching a course that was an Accenture onboarding course in 2015, I believe it was. And as we were onboarding a bunch of new joiners to the company, we were taking down a list of topics that people wanted to learn about or get up to speed on. And someone called out blockchain is something they wanted to learn about. And at the time, I probably had heard a bit about it before, but wasn't ready to stand up in front of a room and diagram out how a consensus mechanism works. So I jotted it down and thought on the side, people are asking about this, I should start to learn about it. But I didn't really get immersed in it enough to be able to properly teach people about it for a few years later still. But I do remember it coming up in that course as an interest for guys coming out of college. And that kind of struck me as, okay, this is catching on a little bit and starting to shape conversations.
And you do not have to name clients or release any specifics, but where are clients at in the stages of education? Are they at a place where... So I taught elementary education for the first 5 years of my career. So are they a first grader, or are they getting into high school, and where are they at along that journey? And like, how do you help Slalom with like helping them move from their knowledge they have today into their knowledge that they want to learn tomorrow?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's totally a mixed bag. So anyone who has reached a certain level in their business career dealing with technology is obviously going to have a very strong technical aptitude with traditional technology or legacy technology or Web 2 tech or whatever you want to call it. But there's a pretty big shift in moving from the Web 2 world to the Web 3 world and being able to communicate in terms of mental models you've built for understanding how that technology works. So we do see a lot of clients who are essentially at the starting point of just starting to learn about Web3 and some of the paradigms that it's built on and who need us to walk them through the process. Yeah, the other thing that we see a lot of is companies hiring people externally to come in and shape up and lead a blockchain or a Web3 practice. And then it's basically their job to come into the company to start teaching about Web3, to educate the rest of the employees there about how do we work in the new world and what are some of the new assumptions that we're operating with here. And then it's their job to educate. But from a big picture standpoint, there's a huge need for education. There's a huge need to set the foundation a certain way and bring people up to speed step by step, starting from square one. So we see a lot of that, and we do a lot of at the ground level and building the foundation from there.
So we spoke about a week ago, and I wrote down some notes. So let's dig into where you see decentralization. And I wrote down in the notes, you talked about Airbnb. Could you name some examples of decentralization and where you think that it's headed in the next year or so that people can grasp onto? I don't want this conversation to turn into this airy fairy, this might happen, but like, where do you see it going that real people can actually hold on to and do something with?
Yeah, it's a tough question to talk through in simple terms because it's a very complex topic and you can get very philosophical about it as you dig into it. But without going completely down that rabbit hole, I'll try to give a little flavor of some of the intuition around it and then ground it in reality and in something that people have experienced with the Airbnb example that we spoke about briefly. One really cool pie in the sky philosophical take I heard about decentralization and technology is humans with their technology are learning to replicate some of the systems that has persisted biologically as life has developed. All right, now that sounds, and talk about what that means. If you talk to a biologist and study the way that life has developed throughout time, when cells learn to copy their information across many individual cells, that's when life started proliferating on Earth. Because if you've got genetic data and a single point of failure, that's too easy for it to get wiped out and the species is dead. So life really started growing and spreading on Earth when cells would copy their data across many individual cells so that if a few get wiped out, the information is still there in other places. They can then replicate, combine with other cells, pass on their data, blah, 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 and grow. And if you follow that process of decentralizing something so that it becomes more robust and more mature, that's happened throughout technological growth really throughout time. But you can just zoom in on the internet age and see that. So if you take the three generations of the web that people like to talk about, they'll typically break down the web into web 1, web 2, web 3. Web one is read-only internet. You just look at web pages. You take the information that's there. That's it. Web two is you can read and write to the internet. So Twitter comes along, Facebook comes along. Now what we're looking at on the internet isn't just put there for us, but we're contributing to it. We're content creating together with a group to form the internet. And now Web3 is read and write and own. So you can actually track what data belongs to which person or entity that contributed to it with all of the blockchain technology underlying it. But there's a different take on this Web1, Web2, Web3 paradigm, which is what human activity got decentralized with each version of the web. So if you think about it, not from read, write, own, but from human activity that's built on top of it, Web one was the decentralization of communication. So before Web one, if I want to write back and forth with someone and I want to put in some memes and pictures and graphics and all of this other stuff that we can do online, I'm relying on a post office to do that. A post office is a big central point of failure that's slow and that takes a lot of time to work through. Web 1 comes along, email protocols get built on top of it, HTTP protocols get built on top of it, and now from my computer, I can go point to point with anyone in the world, communicating back and forth in real time. So it's a more efficient way of decentralizing that human activity as opposed to what was there before. Content creation in Web 2 is previously, before Web 2, it's reliant on a certain team maintaining a website, right? So the website admin has to create the content, update the web pages, on and on. And then JavaScript gets developed in the mid-90s, and all the internet technology evolves to allow users to read and write data back and forth on the site. And now what, you know, took, I don't know how often web pages were updated in 1993, but probably not that often. Now they update in real time. Users put data there. The site updates itself. As soon as your buddy posts a funny tweet, you see it. Everything is happening in a much more decentralized, efficient manner. So now we get to Web 3, which is also another decentralization play. This one is a little bit trickier because Web 3 is a back-end revolution, right? Web 2 is a front-end revolution. Web 2 was changing the technology that's built into your browser so that it can capture data more efficiently and you actually see it in the browser. The browsers look different, you interact with it. So people understand the Web 2 change a bit more intuitively. Web 3 is all happening on the back end with databasing and data processing. So at its core, blockchain is a database. It stores data and processes data that's feeding to the website. The decentralization play is breaking the single point of failure on a single database on a single server, and the databasing activity is happening across a network of computers that's collaborating together to store and process the data while following rules that keep them in agreement about what the real data is. So that's essentially the revolution. But the human activity that is now built on top of that is commerce, the ability to make payments directly from point to point without anyone needing to intermediate that payment. So before Web3, if I want to pay you something online, I can send it to you via whatever app, PayPal, Venmo, my bank, whatever. But for that payment to go through, we need a third party to clear the books. So my bank has to say, take it out of my account, update how much money I have, make sure it gets cleared against your bank ledger, they update their account. And to us, it looks like it just went from me to you, but it takes a while. If I do it on a Sunday, it's not going to clear for a bit because somebody has to come to work and actually do the clearing of the transaction. With Web3, that same thing can happen without anyone else being involved. The ledgers will update themselves following the rules, and a payment can go from me to you in a matter of minutes instead of a matter of days like it was before. So again, you have this decentralization play that's taking commerce as a human activity and breaking the reliance on middlemen to be able to facilitate that. That was a lot, so let me take a breath and kind of reel it back and touch on the Airbnb example, which you mentioned. But the Airbnb example works well because most people who will listen to this podcast have had experience with Airbnb, some both as a host and as a guest. But Airbnb as a whole is not a purely decentralization play. Like, Airbnb is one big centralized company, and a lot of people will catch that and say, wait, hold on, why are we talking about Airbnb and decentralization? They're just one big company that kind of operates worldwide, and that's true. Not all aspects of Airbnb are decentralized. But if you think about what a hotel is, it's essentially a broker for a place to stay. It's a big physical space with a lot of rooms inside, and that has to be centralized into one place. When Airbnb comes along, all of those individual rooms inside the same building can then be spread out across a city. And not only that, but rooms can be converted into a hotel room and then converted back into your guest room or your storage room or whatever you want it to be very efficiently in a short amount of time. Similarly, a lot of the job functions that it takes to run the hotel can be decentralized away from one person and efficiently performed by people who are just performing the job function for a short amount of time and then ceasing to perform that. So a good example is the agent at the front desk of the hotel. You go to a hotel, especially in a less busy area, you've got someone sitting at the front desk for 24 hours a day. It's not the same person, they switch out, but you've got to have that desk staffed 24 hours a day. Of those 24 hours, how many hours are they actually engaged in doing some kind of work? I don't know, eight maybe? We'll say eight, give or take. So that's 16 hours where they have to be there. They're getting paid, but they're not doing any productive activity. They're still on the clock. That's just a waste. It's inefficiency. Now, with Airbnb, that gets decentralized away to me. I'm the agent at the desk, and it's managed through my phone. So if I have someone staying in a spare room or in a rental property I have, they can message me anytime I need something. I instantly become the agent. I text them back, give them the information they need, and then I stop. And I go back to doing whatever else I was doing. I was on the clock for 2 minutes. As soon as I stop performing that function, I'm right back to the old job. So this is a framework to think about how decentralization operates as a system and how it can add efficiency into the system, even from previous to Web3 companies that are starting to innovate by decentralizing certain aspects of the system.
I do not understand the technology behind this. I know a little bit about coding, but not to this level. But explain to me, so I think at a base level, I understand decentralization, and I understand the efficiency of it. My question is, what do you do about privacy? How is this block of information able to stay secure as it travels, in your example, to somebody staying somewhere, somebody else getting paid, and how do they know that they're there, and how do they know that the information stays secure? Explain that process to me.
Yeah, as it relates to blockchain?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to come to understand. And just to give a little bit of the anecdotal background to this problem, it helps to understand how blockchain was developed and why it was developed in the first place. So if you go back to the early 90s, very early internet culture, you had a lot of technologists and visionaries who imagined this world of being able to pay people online just like you pay people in the real world. They thought, wouldn't it be great if we had a digital cash system where I could pay you without anybody else being involved? Like, this is easy in the physical world, right? If I owe you $20, I take a $20 bill out of my wallet, I hand it to you, you have it, I don't, that's it, we're done. Nobody else needs to be involved there. So what people would try to do is they would try to develop a way to allow people to pay each other online the same way, point-to-point direct transactions. The problem is, in the digital world, currency is based on files, and files can be copied and manipulated and tinkered with. So there have always been ways to cheat the system where, you know, a clever developer or someone who just is a bit of a scheming con artist can manipulate a file, send a file representing a unit of payment to one person, and then at the same time send a file representing the same unit of payment to another person, get goods in exchange for what they sent. And by the time someone figures out, wait a minute, something's off here, he's already cheated the system, right? It took too long to figure that out. So this problem became known as the double spending problem. And people tried to solve it for about 20 years. There were academic researchers and brilliant entrepreneurs and people who had PhDs in cryptography and all kinds of other fields who had looked at this and said there must be some way to solve this so that we can just let people go point to point without needing intermediaries. But nobody ever could. Every brilliant solution that someone would come up with failed because eventually it would need a third party to clear all the transactions in the system. The legend of blockchain and Bitcoin comes in when, in 2009, the the guy with a fake name publishes a white paper online that says, hey, I solved it. I fixed the problem. We can conquer double spending now. We're all good. And everyone's like, really? And they start reading over the paper and looking at his solution. And over time, people gradually realize this guy solved it. So that's the story. It was like the culmination of efforts over a couple of decades to figure out how to do this. In terms of how it works, to really understand it, it takes probably a couple of hours of going through like detailed examples. There are some great YouTube videos out there I can share that walk people through the steps. But to sum it up very briefly, the original consensus mechanism for Bitcoin is called proof of work. And it takes elements of cryptography and combines it into a math problem that computers that are participating in the network have to solve in order to continue to take part in the network. So the idea is by giving the entire network math problems to solve that take on average about 10 minutes to work through, it creates a system such that a bad actor would have to spend more resources trying to beat that system and trying to expend computer energy to solve those math problems faster. That would cost him so much money, he would lose more trying to beat the system than he would gain by robbing the system of however much money he's able to get his hands on. But that's a very rough explanation. So the punchline is it comes down to hard math problems that computers have to solve, but that's a little insight into what's happening in the background.
Yeah, so go into that if you can. How did they assume that it was more expensive to solve the problem to get the money than it would be to not solve the problem? How did they come to that conclusion?
It's not so much a conclusion. It's a system that kind of guarantees that will always be the case. So right now, you've probably heard of Bitcoin mining, right? Bitcoin mining is the process of solving hard math problems to win the right to add a transaction to the network. So anytime there are new transactions put in what's called a meme pool, which is basically just a holding cell for new transactions people are submitting, you've got Bitcoin miners who are grabbing out groups of transactions, packaging them up and saying, okay, this should be the next group of transactions that's added to the network. But before it has the right to add those transactions to the network, it has to figure out a missing piece called a NOTS that is part of the overall cryptographic link that's going to link those transactions to the rest of the transactions throughout the history of blockchain. In order to find the missing piece, it has to solve a math problem that cannot be solved with a formula, right? So if I say 6x equals 18, we all know how to take one side of the equation, divide by 6, divide 18 by 6, and x equals 3. That's a nice, easy formula. Bitcoin is run by making computers solve problems that do not have formulas to get to the solution. They're basically having to figure out a bunch of complicated prime numbers. The only way to do that is to guess over and over and over and over very quickly, as fast as you can go. So the game is, get the fastest supercomputer you can get to try to solve that problem as quickly as you can, right? There's a piece of the Bitcoin network called the hash rate, which essentially means the total amount of computing power that's online right now. The higher that goes, the more computing power that comes online to try to solve the hard math problems, the more difficult the problem gets. If the hash rate goes down, the problems get a little bit easier. So it's always scaling to keep the difficulty of the problem at a place that will take about 10 minutes to solve. And for someone to try to jump in and hijack the system, they just have to get more powerful computers than are already there. Some of the Bitcoin mining rings are these massive server farms in China and Russia that are just huge warehouses of supercomputers all dedicated towards solving these problems. For us to beat that, we're going to have to spend hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars to try to overpower those things. Nobody can do that. It's not worth spending millions of dollars to steal a few Bitcoin in the most recent transaction group because, yeah, Bitcoins are worth a lot. You steal a few, you get a few $100,000, but you spent millions of dollars to get there. So it creates this incentive system where the only practical way to beat the network is to spend way more money than you could get back out of it, which is a very clever bit of engineering behind it.
Do you see, so at the same time, blockchain, Web3, DeFi, all of these words have come into popular vernacular. ChatGPT and AI have equally come into the common lingo. Do you see a connection there? Do you see a world where artificial intelligence and blockchain meet up? And what does that look like? Or do you see them as different paths? Do you see them as blockchain has risen to popular vernacular for its own reasons, and then separately, AI has reached its level of popular vernacular, and they're two completely separate things?
Yeah, it's a great question, but I think there are a lot of different angles you could come at it from. So to start with, I can tell you a little bit of what the conversation was like behind the scenes with AI 6 to 8 years ago, which is when I was working with a lot of AI teams.
Yeah, that's okay. This will be interesting then, because you have history in both worlds.
Yeah, I've got a little history in each. So 6 to 8 years ago, if you talked to the most advanced AI researchers, a lot of them will tell you there's nothing intelligent about this. We're just programming computers to solve statistics problems very quickly and efficiently. And yeah, it's useful. It can do useful things and give you useful information. But AI, this is just branding. It's not really intelligent. It's very narrowly focused at this specific problem. And then I wouldn't say AI went dormant, but I would say amongst the biggest companies that were investing in AI research and putting a lot of money behind AI projects, they got to a level playing field so that there wasn't a ton of hype around AI for the past few years. Until ChatGPT hits the scene, everybody goes and uses it and sees how freakishly good it is at making conversation, and it explodes in popularity again. There's this piece of thinking I like a lot by Gartner, the research firm, called the Gartner Hype Cycle. And the Gartner Hype Cycle is this graph where early in the stages of a technology, it zips up. And then it crashes really hard when people are like, oh, it's not that great. And then it comes up and plateaus and reaches the steady state. So I feel like AI has now gone through the complete hype cycle where, early 2010 or so, when it was starting to become more real, everybody freaks out about it's going to change the world, solve all of our problems, cure world hunger, whatever it's going to do. And then it hits around 2015, 2016, it's like, oh, it's not that impressive. It's just solving math problems, blah, blah, blah. And now we've reached this point where, whoa, it actually does some cool stuff here and really does operate now like a proper AI that seems intelligent. And lately, the conversation has come back around, do we have to worry about artificial general intelligence taking us over and exterminating all the humans, which is a dark subject, but people are talking about that a lot lately. So I think AI has now completed the hype cycle, so to speak. It'll continue to grow and improve and innovate, but we've gone through this initial burst of excitement, this crash, and then the surprise innovation. Blockchain is earlier in its maturity through that hype cycle. So I would actually say blockchain has gone through a recurring hype cycle of kind of up and down and up and down with various innovations. And answering your question, are these things going to merge or are they going to exist independently? I think inevitably they will begin to merge. I think the question of how and what that looks like is still in the realm of futurism. I think when people answer that question, they're probably telling you more about their imaginations than that they know directly. It's very hard to predict what innovations will look like. But I will say that they're both distinctly very good at specific things. Blockchain is very good at maintaining an indisputable source of truth. So this was the original Bitcoin breakthrough. One of the key insights from the original Bitcoin white paper was the only way to create a system where you can be sure that no shady activity occurred, that is like duplicating your spinning or whatever, is to create a system where every transaction can be seen by everyone all the time. And that's what Bitcoin is. It's a completely open database. You can see the entire history of every transaction that's ever occurred in the network. And that's how people prevent double spending. AI, on the other hand, is very good at managing complexity. People don't even know how AI is doing the things it's doing anymore. You give it some starting instructions, it starts running through massively complex math problems, and then it gives you results that get better and better at reaching a certain endpoint. But a lot of times people don't know what's going on inside the black box. So you have AI managed complexity combined with blockchain sourced truth. And the thing that we know about AI is the better data you put into it, the better results you get out. So I see blockchain as a way of giving AI better and more accurate data than it's ever had before. Because let's be honest, the databases that are maintaining the data that goes into AI today is highly flawed and highly fragmented and incomplete. So if you massively improve the quality of the data that you're feeding into these algorithms, which blockchain is well positioned to do, then you have this very happy marriage of AI managed complexity built on blockchain sourced truth. And that's a wild future to think about. We'll see where it goes.
I've seen the Gartner hype cycle, and it reminds me. So in 2018, 2019, I read a book. Let's see what the title of that was. By Kai-Fu Lee, AI Superpowers. And he's like a computer scientist and thinks a lot more deeply than I have the ability to about it. And I figured that it would by now be changing people's diapers.
If only.
Yeah, I know. And I think it'll be an interesting decade, because I think there are some people that say that it will eliminate all copywriters forever. And then there are other people that say it won't do it because it can't bring that personal touch. So it'll be an interesting decade. I wonder where the jobs, I think it will have an impact on jobs. And so I wonder what jobs it will open up. I would imagine that service industries, like helping people get out of bed, taking care of old people in nursing homes, those will go up. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's hard to say. You can think about it from a couple of different angles. So one, is there a business value to be found in AI doing the things that you used to have humans to do? And the answer is unquestionably, yeah, there is. So there's no question in my mind at all that ChatGPT just by itself is about as good as your average entry-level analyst into a new organization. It can do things at about that level. It doesn't always give you accurate answers. It can be wrong, but it's useful. And
but
it can...
Neither do 22-year-old entry-level
neither do they. So I think what we're looking at in a lot of situations is you could replace the analyst with AI, but then who's going to become your consultants and your managers and your managing directors one day? You got to still grow people through that job cycle. And then you have the perspective that what's truly better than just the analyst or the AI is the analyst that is trained on how to use the AI to be overall more effective. So you're going to see a lot of merging of humans learning to use AI in clever ways to be super productive. I do think that the race is on right now for all of us to figure out, how do we use tools to speed up our own productivity to get twice as much done in an 8-hour day as we used to get done? I'm still figuring that out. So sometimes, you know, I'll try a couple of things in the ChatGPT prompt and I'll think, I could write something better than this and stop focusing on it. But I've had people show me, you're just not being patient enough in giving it the right instructions so that it understands exactly how you want it to give you output. And when you look at some very precise prompts, the output does get pretty crazy good. You've seen a lot. I don't know if you pay much attention to the Twitter scene, but there's always a new set of prompts that gets tweeted around every week or two with someone figuring out something else that's interesting and useful. So I think right now the best approach is to focus on people learning to work with AI together to just boost overall productivity.
Where do you, because it's obvious you're a pretty deep thinker, where do you get your information and how do you express that in ways that like gets you to say it in such, I know this, you've answered some questions pretty long, but still they're very succinct. How do you practice that?
Repetition. Repetition is the best thing for getting good at communicating certain things to certain groups. It's always good to know your audience. You scale up or you scale down a little bit based on who you're talking to and what you think their starting point of knowledge is. And writing helps a lot. A lot of the things that I talk about, I've got a few things going on as iterative activities that come up. So right now I'm doing a monthly webinar series. I'll shoot you some information on that. It's completely open. Anybody in the audience that wants to join, where we just talk about Web3, how it's impacting business and other topics that come up. And my system for preparing for that is about a month or 6 weeks before I need to give the next series. I'll try to get my main ideas that I want to communicate, and I'll write a blog post about it. And the process of writing a blog post, sometimes my writing time that I have blocked off is made up of me writing two or three sentences and spending an hour and 55 minutes pacing around my apartment, drinking coffee, furiously trying to think of like, how do I want to say this thing? But after you just grind it out and get those points nice and tight, that's it. That's the right analogy to introduce something. That's the right framework to bring an audience up to speed. So yeah, the morning time pacing around is really useful for straining through how to communicate an idea. And then once you can write it out in a consistent, clear manner, you're then ready to talk about it a bit more.
What's your work schedule? Is it like the traditional 8 to 5, or do you like getting up earlier and maybe being done earlier? What's your system for doing that?
So I'll give a little plug here. Have you ever heard of a guy named Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert? So pretty heavily influenced by his system, which he wrote about, and he's written a bunch of books. I think it was How to Fail and Still Win Big. I'm butchering the title a little bit, but it's close to that. And a lot of the book is about systems that will increase your productivity. So I read that book. I thought I was doing really well at the time that I read it, waking up at 6 a.m. and making a good breakfast and getting ready for the day. And in this book, he talks about tweaking his own productivity to become super productive by waking up at 4 a.m. every day. And I was like, man, I thought I was killing it before 4 a.m. So I started trying that, actually, like adjusting the schedule in the week to be in the bed with the lights off at 9, waking up around 4. The rush of energy you have in the morning, at least for me, is so much better than anything else you have throughout the day. You can just churn out work very quickly. So I adapted to it, and I'm not perfectly airtight sticking to the schedule all the time, but I do more often than not. And I get more work done between 5 a.m. and 8 a.m., I think, than I did in a full day of work before I got onto that system pretty tightly. So yeah, early morning work hours is like getting the heavy lifting done when the energy levels are high, and that's been key for me.
So I know you said when we talked earlier, you have a tendency to maybe go on rants sometimes.
Yeah, a little bit.
But I wonder, so back to blockchain. Where are we at, and where I want you to phrase this answer to normal people. Think of people in Frankfort, Kentucky, or Omaha, Nebraska. How can they grasp on to something that's happening in the blockchain world? So where do you see that it will impact their lives? It might be through, your answer might be through the Starbucks app, but where do you see them interacting with blockchain, and how can it benefit their lives?
A few areas that come to mind right off as reinterpreting the question as where is going to be the entry point for mainstream adoption for people who aren't already blockchain nerds, who is going to start to see the products that they care about. I think there are a few candidates. I think a big candidate is gaming. For anyone who is a gamer, who spends time on any gaming platform or any gaming world, there's a high chance that Web3 gaming is going to start to become more and more popular. There are a lot of projects out there right now that are working on solutions to bring Web3 gaming mainstream. And so when we say Web3 gaming, what does that mean? It means that you own items in the game, and sometimes you pay for them, sometimes you might earn them through gameplay, but they're unique trackable items that can be assigned to you. In a lot of cases, that can probably be traded or sold, just like you could trade or sell a physical item. The merger of gaming with an item like a skin that you might put on your avatar that you own, that belongs to you, that you can sell, maybe that you can rent out for a month and let somebody else borrow while they play a game or play the game. I think there's a lot of momentum around that right now, a lot of projects that are working on those kinds of solutions, and a lot of very clever projects that are trying to introduce that in a way where you don't need to know anything about Web3 or blockchain to say, hey, in this game, you own your skins and you can sell it to somebody else if you want. Everybody gets that. If you're a gamer, you understand that without knowing anything about blockchain. So is blockchain behind that use case? Yes, it's just not in your face. I think another potential entry point, I'll touch on a couple more. DeFi is getting more interesting. So there was a use case 2 or 3 weeks ago where someone bought a house on chain, which means they purchased a home by having a token that pointed at that home transferred to their wallet. And when they purchased that home, they took out a loan through a DeFi lending platform, not a traditional bank. So DeFi is getting gradually more mature, and we're starting to see some use cases where maybe if you're someone who's been shut out of the traditional financial system for whatever reason, you now have another option to go take out a DeFi loan that is going to be accessible to you even where traditional loans haven't been. I would put that as a candidate as well. Yeah, those two come to mind. Finance, gaming. I think music could be an interesting one. You're seeing more and more music projects announced that are Web3 focused lately. So MasterCard, Sony, Spotify, all three of those companies have announced music projects in the past couple of months. I think the Spotify one is very cool because essentially what they're doing is they're building a feature into the Spotify app where if you're a member of a certain social community, and you've probably had some exposure to the Bored Apes, the Mutant Apes, the communities that are built on these profile pictures that are backed by tokens that have specific art linked to them, right? If you're a member of that community, or of select communities that are being used in beta testing, maybe not this specifically, but there's integration being built into Spotify where they can collaborate on their own playlist together. And Spotify will recognize if you're a holder of one of those tokens and let you look at playlists that other people in the community are making. I think that's very smart because that mimics the way that we learn about new music in the real world, right? So the last band you got into, I would say there's a pretty good chance you heard about it from your buddy or if someone invited you to a concert, you heard something new. And this is how people learn about new music is through friends and conversations and, oh, you got to listen to this song I just heard on the radio. So now mimicking that process that's always played out in the real world and making it work in the digital world is a very promising use case.
So you touched on this earlier. I think it'd be beneficial to explain what DeFi is. I don't know that all that many people, I think people understand banks. I don't think people, the masses really understand what DeFi is.
I'm admittedly not a DeFi expert, so I'm going to just explain it in very simple terms and then say for anyone that wants to go deeper, you're probably going to learn more through a sharp YouTube video that I'll give you right here. But essentially, you had early blockchain use cases that were Bitcoin. Bitcoin was the first. You can just send tokens to each other, and those tokens can be traded for real value. Like Bitcoin is always fluctuating against the dollar now. So there's real financial value in those tokens that can be sent point to point. So on top of that, people started building use cases like, okay, so what if we let someone commit a certain amount of digital assets as collateral for a loan? So maybe I can say I have 100 Bitcoin locked up, which would be worth quite a lot today. I'll lock 20% of this Bitcoin up in a contract, and in return, I want a loan on top of that with the Bitcoin guaranteeing it. This is a very elementary level use case. I'm just trying to describe the concepts here. But all of these financial products that are built on, or that are built in the same way that banks have traditionally offered them, people are inventing ways to make those offerings on blockchain-based solutions that aren't backed by big centralized institutions, like banks aren't facilitated by those institutions, but that are built on top of the point-to-point individual activity that people have always engaged with through blockchain.
I've always had an interest in blockchain in healthcare. Not always. I haven't always had an interest in it. Since I learned about blockchain, I think the intersection of blockchain and healthcare has always been interesting to me. Have you seen any use cases out there? Have you had any thoughts about how those two are going to intersect?
I've heard about a couple of big use cases, and I know that it's been a big focus for certain startups in the space. So, anyone who has worked in healthcare or has just had an experience with various healthcare providers knows that it can be a challenge to facilitate medical information from doctor to doctor, especially if you move between different countries.
Yes.
It's difficult to look back at what's happened with you in the past. Records get lost very easily. And as we touched on before, blockchain is at its core a very trustworthy source of truth for a given set of information. So I know that there have been at least a few big time startups that have focused on bringing a better source of truth to the healthcare industry so that individuals can put records onto the chain that can be accessed by the right people at the right time without those records being compromised and open to anyone. Now, of course, that's a challenge because one of the things we said earlier is blockchain is this open source of information and everyone can look at it and see what's been put on chain, which is true. So if you're putting sensitive data on a blockchain, you've got to come up with clever ways to mask it so that only the right people can access it at a certain point in time and your medical data isn't exposed to the whole world. Obviously, that would be a problem. I don't know what the latest is with those projects. I haven't been as focused on healthcare lately, but there are definitely a lot of ideas out there and a lot of things in the works for what could be done.
Wrapping it up, what are you doing? We've got a few minutes left. What are you doing, you yourself, either for your company or just on the side? I know you're doing the weekly or monthly webinars. What else are you releasing to the public to let them consume? Talk about that.
Yeah, so a couple of big things right now are blogging. I write a lot of blogs on a lot of topics, so a Medium page where all of that's released, and people are free to go there and get their hands on educational content mostly. So a lot of what I focus on is when I started getting into the space more heavily from a professional angle, I realized we got a big problem here. And the problem was, no one is explaining this world in a way that normal people are going to even begin to be able to grasp. Blockchain is hard. It's hard, like it doesn't matter how smart you are. If you really want to understand this technology and all of the various projects that are being built on top of it, it takes time and effort and commitment. And the reality is, most people don't have that much time. They can't sit down and spend 2 hours a day to read about something if they're not like deeply invested in it. So my goal through a lot of what I write is to simplify what's going on into simple stories and anecdotes that are a little bit fun and interesting to read about, and that start to communicate the concepts in this Web3 world so that people can get it not through these explanations about decentralized ledgers and immutability and zero knowledge proofs, because no one knows what the hell any of that means. But that takes the ideas behind those things, puts it into a story that might be interesting to read about, and then by the time you're done reading it, it's like, oh, I see like how that works or what's going on there. That's a big piece of it. I'm running a monthly webinar right now that will go at least through June, focused on the intersection of blockchain and Web3 with the business world, how it's starting to impact companies, how we've seen projects develop, what some best practices are for companies that want to get into that space, so on and so forth. And then in whatever free time I have after that, I'm always engaging with people on Twitter in the Web3 space. I think that one of the big mistakes a lot of businesses make is they don't immerse themselves in the culture prior to trying to get involved. It's important to remember there's been a whole culture built around Web3 or around these principles of openness, of decentralization, of people being able to transact independently. And there are a lot of values that have grown out of that. So to succeed, you need to know people who are at ground zero, who have been there for a long time with them, and get to know them. I think that's an important part of the process.
Could you tell me where people could connect with you if they hear this episode? Where could they find you?
Best place is Twitter, which is at ACQuinn_. That's ACQUIN with an underscore at the end. Unfortunately, someone beat me to ACQuinn without the underscore, so I have to add that thing on. Also, Medium is, I believe, medium.com/Quinn-Essential, E-S-E-N-T-I-L. I like to play with the last name a bit, so it fits into a lot of things. Those are the best two places. I'm fairly active on Twitter and always happy to connect with people there and get to know folks.
I appreciate you coming on. You are definitely a deep thinker, but I can also tell that you're a teacher because you try to explain things at least to where I can understand them. And so that was helpful today. So thanks for coming on.
Hey, it was a blast to be here. Happy to do it again sometime. And I look forward to staying in touch.